War in the Pacific, All History, 92-4, take 9.
Today is January 27, 1992. Could you please state your name?
My name is Peter C. Sigüenza.
Pete, could you talk a little bit about, you were with the 3rd Marine Division, could you just talk a little bit about that, your time being in?
I was with the 3rd Marine Division during World War II. I enlisted in the Marine Corps in April 1942 at San Diego, California, and I trained at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego. I happened to be there because I was attending school. I was a sophomore at San Diego State College. After training at the Recruit Depot, I was sent to Camp Elliott to join the 3rd Marine Division. And from Camp Elliott, we went to Camp Pendleton to complete our training. And from Camp Pendleton, we went overseas. And the first stop was New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand. From New Zealand, we went to Guadalcanal. And we trained at Guadalcanal for Pacific jungle operations. And our first operation with the 3rd Marine Division was the invasion of Bougainville on 1 November 1943. The next operation was Guam, or the 3rd Marine Division. I was with the division, and we were in a convoy on transport. I was on the USS DuPage coming to Guam. Outside of Guam at Assam, my orders came through for me to return to the States because I was selected to go to Officers Candidate School. I asked our commanding general, who happened to be aboard the ship I was on, the DuPage. I asked our commanding general, General Turnage, if I could get permission to not return to the States because I wanted to make the landing at Guam, but he told me that as a Marine, my duty was to obey the orders of the Marine Corps. So I proceeded to, I was transferred to a destroyer, and on that destroyer we were sent back to Pearl Harbor, and Pearl Harbor to California, and from California to Quantico, Virginia. When I was commissioned, I was flown out to Guam to rejoin the 3rd Marine Division. At that time, it was already secured. My buddies had gone back because it was time for them to be returned. So I joined another outfit, and we were training here in Guam for the invasion of Japan. And during the period that we were in training, problems were occurring around the island, principally the bases where the U.S. troops were, for instance, the CB camp at Assam, that they were reporting harassment fire from Japanese. So one of the battalions that was sent out to clear that area was my battalion from the 3rd Marine Division, 3rd Regiment. We were organized into combat patrols to secure the area from Commander Naval Forces Mariana Comnav Mar, the top of the Mar today, down to Marine Drive and all the way to Agat. In this operation, there must have been about 15 patrols operating on line down towards the sea. We succeeded in flushing out some Japanese stragglers who were behind the village of Tepungan. And this took place for about 2 weeks. And the result was successful because I understand that the area was cleared and there'd be no more harassment fire. The process was to continue training for the Japan invasion when on September 2, 1945, while we were stationed at Jotunya, Guam, the message came in that the Japanese, that the war was over. The Japanese had surrendered. So there was much joy among the troops of the 3rd Marine Division. Many of the people who had been overseas for a long time were getting ready to be returned to the States. I remained in Guam because I happened to be in the regular Marine Corps. I was not a reservist, so I had to wait my time. And I served, the 3rd Marine Division was disorganized, and some of the men joined other units. Some went to China, some went to other places. I was retained right here in Guam, and I was assigned to Island Command. Island Command was the organization that had responsibility for the government of the island, the predecessor of the government of Guam. It was under the command of a Marine two-star general, General Larson. And while I was with the Island Command, I served my time until mid-1946, when I served my 4 years of active duty and I was returned to San Diego.
Can you talk a little bit about during the time that you were scouting for the Japanese in the jungle areas? And some locals served as scouts that assisted the 3rd Marine Division.
There were some interesting experiences for me because in many of the villages I would either have relatives or close friends, and they would see us either passing through the village or passing in the back of the village. And on one of these occasions, I remembered one gentleman whom I knew before the war, who asked me if I had lunch already, and I said no. And whether I had lunch or not, I don't think I would have admitted it anyway, because we were having sea ration. So he asked me if I wanted to eat some more food. He said he had Dungeness crab, cooked the chamorro way, and rice. So of course I accepted his offer, and I went to his home, took a little time off, and ate with him. The other experience was a little humorous way, because as we were passing behind the village of Tipungan, which is next to Piti, the homes there that where the people lived had open windows. And one of the ladies inside the house looked out, and in Chamorro said that no wonder the Marines can't catch Japanese, because they're looking for women. Of course, I thought that was a little ridiculous. So I stopped my platoon, and they were all anxious, what was the woman saying, and what was I saying to her? And I said, well, you folks have a reputation that you're after women, not Japanese. And of course, they disagreed with that. But because I was speaking Chamorro, this woman didn't know that there'd be a Chamorro Marine, and she almost fell out of the window. She was quite surprised. I didn't identify myself, but I didn't ask her name either. But I'm pretty sure that she was very much surprised that somebody would understand what she just said. I didn't consider it derogatory, but it was a little amusing and humorous, because Marines are Marines wherever they are, and I cannot say that they're not interested in women.
Talk about, you'd mentioned before about the...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the Japanese stragglers and what process was that?
It was our experience that the Japanese, remaining Japanese troops, the stragglers, were... very strongly motivated not to surrender. I had an experience where during one of these patrols, I was given a Japanese officer to help us, and he had a speaker with him, and his function was to speak out at the edge of the jungle for these people to come out if they're still in there, because the war was over. It was my observation that because there were still Japanese stragglers after our patrols, that they saw and heard the encouragement by their own troop, by their own officer, to come out and give up. But they apparently they were not all willing to do that. Example, there were many years later, there were two Japanese stragglers that that came up. They were found, I think, in the Marble area near Didido-Jigo. And of course, the well-known Yokoi, Sergeant Yokoi, after 28 years, came out later. He didn't come out. He was found by two local hunters. They found him and had him come in. They captured him, in a sense, so he came in. But I don't believe that, at least I heard of no Japanese straggler who came unwillingly surrendered. I thought that they were very motivated, highly motivated, in not in keeping honor to their country as soldiers of Japan. It'd be very difficult to state a number, because what we were doing really was to flush them out. And I know that the area where we had worked and patrolled, where they were causing harassment fire on some of the camps. After we were through in that area, we thought that we cleaned it out completely, because there were no further harassment fire. So I think at the other end, near the Agat Santa Rita area, two or three Japanese stragglers were caught and were picked up. Whether that was as a result of our battalion in patrol, I'm not sure, but I remember one incident where we almost came up on a Japanese straggler, because we found a sack of rice on the ground, and when we picked it up, it was place where you handle it was still warm. So apparently somebody had been there and didn't have time to take the rice with him, so he left it. So that was another example of these people not wanting to give up and continuing to roam as long as they could.
Were you involved much with the prisoner of war camp?
Pardon me, let me cut here. The sun has come out.
Yeah, the sun has come out. We have a lot of airplane noise, and what I like to hear is really that they have...
The sound is rolling.
Camera?
Rolling.
World on the Pacific, oral history, Mr. Siguenza. 92.5, take 11.
Pete, could you tell us a little bit about what the changes were from pre-war to you actually returning with the 3rd Marine Division in 1944?
Well, I was born in Guam, and I grew up in Agana, and until I was ready for high school. In 1936, I left. In those days, it was a very peaceful, slow type lifestyle. I was young then, and I remembered playing with many of my friends, my age group, and we would be playing in the Plaza de España, and quite often we would wake up early to attend Mass, because we were altar boys and choir boys. And in those days, the masses would be set around 5 o'clock. So before the masses, we would be playing hide and seek in the plaza. And of course, we were making a lot of noise. So now and then, the plaza is right next to the governor's palace. So now and then, the marine sentry from the governor's palace would come over to where we were and tell us to cut the noise down or leave the area. Well, we would leave for a short while until he goes back to his post, and we'd assemble again and start playing. The consternation, and I know that we must have been making a lot of noise. And in those days, the particular noise activities were very much controlled by the existing naval government. It is true that we were forbidden from whistling. We were forbidden from taking and doing many things in Agaña. Not that they were illegal or immoral or whatever, but it was just against the policy of the naval government, principally the Navy, the governor, who usually is a four-striper, a Navy captain. We grew up in those that kind of an atmosphere. I learned early about the distinction between the locals and the statesiders, the Caucasian, because we had two types of school. I went to the public school, and there was an American school where only the children of the officers and the men of the armed forces, the Navy, principally in the Marine Corps, would go. We were not allowed to get near that place. I remember also as a young person that I would like to go to the movies, and because my father was in the Navy, I thought I had privilege, but I would try to enter the movie house at Dorn Hall and would be told to that I couldn't get in. So what we do, we'd be watching the movie from the outside. And again, we were making a lot of racket. And sooner or later, somebody will come out and chase us away. Many incidents like that. But I must say, however, that on balance, the administration of the Navy was beneficial, if not benevolent, to Guam, the islanders, and the islanders, because they stressed sanitation. They provided schools for us. They provided medical care, dental care, so that, and also, of course, they provided the police department, and the police took charge of security around the island. Another thing that I remembered, every male who reaches 16 years of age had to join the Guam militia. I joined the militia myself for a few months because I had to, but I didn't stay too long with the militia because I left Guam to go to school. The distinction between my experiences as a young person here in Guam and the later experiences after, as I came back as a Marine, was very significantly different. Obviously, my first experience when I came back was I saw the destruction of the place, of the island, the homes in Agaña, and I am from Agaña, and I remembered many of the homes and many of my neighbors, my own home. Many of those homes were destroyed by the bombardment by the Navy. Many of the people were given housing in the various villages. They built villages, for instance, in Barrigada and Sinahanya. And many of them moved away from Agaña to go to the respective villages where they were assigned. My parents happened to have a home in Agaña that was still standing, except that the roof was blown off. But it was still habitable, and they stayed there. All they did was put a tarpaulin over the top, and it was they were able to stay there, and they had the benefit of power and water as compared to the other people who lived in villages where that those luxuries were not in existence. My memory of the island during those immediate period after the war was that the place was destroyed, the people were scattered, and the whole thing changed, and I could see that it will never probably change back again, because Agania was people moved out of Agania, and so there was not much activity going on, except that if you want to meet people, local people, Zamora people, you'd have to go to either Barigada or Sinahanya.
We just ran out of tape. Film.
Sound is rolling.
Camera?
Rolling.
World War in the Pacific, Oral History, Mr. Seguenza, 92-6, take 12.
Recently, the island commemorated the 50th anniversary of the Japanese invasion, which was December 8, 1941. And we had several events that took place. One major event was the honoring of the a few local heroes who were in the Insular Guard, and they were the ones who actively resisted as long and as much as they could when the Japanese landed until they were told to surrender by the governor. In commemoration of the 50th anniversary, the Veterans Affairs Office invited after consulting with the veterans group on Guam, invited 10 Japanese war. They were the Japanese troops who were here during World War II. They had a special ceremony up in the Pagat area, where they have a building honoring. They're a leader of theirs. This is a church-related group. I met the 10 Japanese veterans. They're about my age group. And I met each one of them and shook hands with each one of them. I was introduced to them as a captain in the Marine Corps during the World War II. And with that, whether that gave them the impetus to salute or whatever, but they did bow. They bowed low, and of course I recognize that that's a sign of respect for them. And looking at them, I just thought about the war experiences, where at one time I was hunting for them, and my mission was to get rid of them, kill them. The policy of the Marine Corps is that the policy that we were taught in the Marine Corps was to, during invasion and during the process of combat, that we were to eliminate all resistance one way or the other. So I do not remember of any unit close to me who were taking prisoners. If they saw Japanese troops ahead, their mission was to get rid of them. As I talked and shook hands with these people, I thought about that. And I felt that over the years, I told them that I have forgiven. I know that some of my buddies still have the feeling that they were still very much against the Japanese. But my position and my own personal viewpoint is that I have forgiven, and that there is much more to be gained in the world by peace rather than by battle and by war. After World War II, after several other battles, I'm just wondering, what really did we gain? Here we are, we fought the Japanese, and look at where we are now. So that I think that the essence of getting into war has to be considered a lot more closely by our political leaders, because from my viewpoint, it is a waste of manpower and waste of money, waste of funds. And we should be striving towards development of improvement for mankind and to the achievement of peace in the world.